Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Atlantic Bushcraft Adventures. Tonight we are on episode 237 and thought we'd talk a little bit about hiking and bushcraft. And when I say hiking, and I know it's in the description, I don't mean the actual sport, activity, hobby, whatever you want to call it, of hiking. That's a topic for another night. I literally mean how we walk around in the woods. It's one of those things that we probably don't give a second thought about. But there's actually quite a bit that goes into it. Walking around in the woods and different terrains and stuff like that, it's a lot different than just walking across your house. You know what I mean? We go out, we do it, we don't think about it. But subconsciously, there's a lot going on there. At least I think there is. What's your thoughts, Ben?
Well, I mean, it depends on the house. And if you've got Legos in your house.
Fair point. If you go into Willie's room, it could be every bit as bad as going into the woods.
But no, certainly. One of the first thoughts came to my mind when you said that is if anyone who's ever tried to do like orienteering and had to try to figure out what their pace is, your pace will change in terrain quite a bit, actually. So walking through marshes and bogs, you know, each step takes a lot more effort. Walking through high brush and stuff, you're changing things. Walking through a nice level field where you don't have to avoid things, it's going to be much more consistent.
Going uphill and downhill, even if it's a slight incline over a long period, it's going to change your pace quite a bit too.
Yeah. So, I mean, those are the type of things that you do honestly have to think a bit about. And of course, you know, nature is not like man-made. It's not flat and smooth or even flat and level. You know what I mean?
No, 100%. And I guess let's start right at the beginning. So we keep talking about pacing, and I'm sure most people out there do know how to check their pace and stuff like that. But for those that don't, I mean, everybody starts somewhere. It's a pretty easy process. I mean, literally just go out to your driveway, even across your house if you want, measure off a specific distance. Here in Canada, we use like 10 meters. You know what I mean? Actually, more specifically, we use 3 meters because a parking space, at least in Eastern Canada, I assume it's the same over on your side too, Ben, they're exactly 3 meters. So teaching the motorcycle course, that's how we train ourselves to set our pace. Every parking space is 3 meters. As long as you get used to doing that in exactly 3 steps, you know your pace is roughly 1 meter. Makes things really easy for laying out cones and exercises and stuff like that where you don't have to be super accurate. You know what I mean? Like we're talking within inches, maybe feet over the course of 30, 40 meters. You know what I'm talking about? But yeah. It's better than nothing. And that's kind of pacing in the woods. I mean, that's a very roundabout way to describe it, but that's exactly what pacing in the woods is. It gives you a rough estimation. And as Ben said right from the start, you can't just take your pace literally sitting in your house and say, oh yeah, that's my pace for everything. You got to get out there and you got to take your pace in a couple different environments. And then you take the average off your pace kind of over the span of what you're going through. And I mean, you can get as specific as keeping a little logbook. And I know people that used to do that. You know, I was walking in thick brush for 1 hour. I've been walking in open fields for 20 minutes. I've been on groomed path for however long. And they'll really figure their stuff out. Now, the people I'm talking about were generally like flaggers. And I don't mean like the flaggers that turn signs on the road. I mean like flaggers, they're flagging out property boundaries and stuff like that, or linemen or surveyors or something like that. They're looking to get a little more accurate than probably what you and I are, Ben. I would assume maybe you're like that. I don't know.
Well, I haven't been, but in past life, past places, my pacing was very important to me. So there would have been a time I would have paid a lot more attention to it. And I probably would have, for me, broken it down to 3 levels. So easy terrain, moderate terrain, and then rough terrain. And that would be about as far as I really wanted to go with it. But yeah, you would figure out the type you're going to go through and figure out, does it tend to modify my pace and how much does it? And it gets very complicated, but you'll figure it out and you'll get used to it.
And that's a real good point there, is you get used to it. Don't try to, it sounds like we're telling you is to take a lot of notes and overload yourself with information. It's something to work on every time you go out. And the more you do it, the more you get used to it as you go. I didn't learn how to set my pace overnight. Like I grew up working in the woods. I recreationally hung out in the woods basically my entire life. And still today, I find myself in areas where I'm not used to being in different terrain, especially as I travel around more. Not just, you know, as kids, we're always around the house. You're always in the same woods or the same area. You never go too far away. Then you kind of hit your midlife and you travel a little bit more, but it's still never really far away from where you're residing at that time. You know what I mean? There's less going out and adventuring because you're still trying to get your life together. Then as you kind of get into the more of the midlife or the mid-midlife, you know, 30s, 40s, things like that, you tend to travel more. At least when you're bushcrafter, at least I found I did, and the crowds I hung around with, we go out, we walk more, we're looking for places we haven't been before, we're looking for new adventures. And I'm learning now, as I'm going out and doing the stuff and going through the new terrains and different provinces and stuff like that, that I run into, you know, fuel load, I call it fuel loading, but just different terrains, different materials in that terrains that I haven't run into before. And I'm sure this is something you can relate to, Ben. Here in Nova Scotia, when you were over here, we have two kinds of things that we don't have anywhere else in Canada. Now on the fire side of things, we call it NS/1 and NS/2, but it's just kind of this brushy, brambly kind of crap that we get around our coastlines. You know what I mean? It's like waist high bushes that just knot together. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
And that's not a really big thing in the rest of Canada. Like, it's kind of prominent in Eastern Canada, a little bit of PEI, and Nova Scotia. You don't really find it in Newfoundland. It's just kind of a weird thing we got here because of the conditions we have on this side. I'm sure West Coast has something specific to them. And, you know, you're going to have those areas that you're going to get used to. But then when you start traveling outside your areas, you're going to run into stuff you haven't seen. Once again, very roundabout way to get to a very short point.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you'll notice it when you go to different forests. Like, I've used to grow up in some very strong alder forests. And those alder forests would oftentimes be probably 6-7 feet high, maybe a little bit more in some areas, especially if the land was leveled out, the top of the alders all came to the same length regardless of terrain. And that could be very obvious near, like, ditches and stuff. Ditch could be 30 feet deep and all this. But that's very difficult to walk through. It's very much that. And you're pushing trees apart to move, and you're tripping over things, and it's hard work. The quickest thing I would for the West Coast, if you watch the show Alone, when they did the partners, the average team took 10 days to meet up.
And they were only something like 10 kilometers apart or something, weren't they?
10 kilometers apart. I can't remember what it was. In good terrain, somebody could easily walk between 20 and 30 kilometers a day.
The average person's walking speed is something like, what, 2.5 kilometers an hour? Somewhere in and around there. I'm not talking like a saunter, but not really a brisk walk either. You know, a walking with purpose. And I probably should have looked this up. But I mean, yeah, it's still very reasonable to travel 20 kilometers in a day with, and I say relative ease, providing that it's decent terrain and you're a decently fit person. Don't have to be peak physical performance, but you should probably have had a little bit of walking under your belt more. Not a couch potato, I guess. You know what I mean? But yeah, so we set our stride. We know we're going to hit different things. Other things that we do that we don't really think
about is... 5 kilometers per hour.
5 kilometers an hour? That seems a little quick.
Wikipedia.
Oh, maybe I'm thinking miles. Yeah, I could be thinking miles.
I just looked it up on Wikipedia because it was something interesting. The preferred walking speed is the speed at which humans or animals choose to walk. Many people tend to walk around 5.1 kilometers per hour. Individuals find slower or faster speeds uncomfortable.
Well, there you go. So 5 kilometers an hour, we're only talking 4 to 5 hours worth of walking to put you at 20 kilometers in decent conditions.
In decent conditions. In rough conditions, they said they were lucky to clear 1 kilometer a day.
Nomad joining us there. He's just stopping in for a quick second. Got errands to run. Thanks for stopping in, Nomad. It's always good to see you, man. I know you got to get out there and get your life ready, but maybe catch us on the audio side of things. We know you'd be here if you could.
But yeah, I mean, so there's a few things. I looked it up, what the military considered one pace. And that's, I think the distance from 1 foot lifting to that same foot laying down is 30 inches.
Okay.
That's an average pace for the average person. That means shorter people end up having to extend their pace, and taller people have to shorten it a little bit. But if you watch a march, everyone is walking the exact same step count. So everyone has to make the same length. So that would be in a march. So it's just giving an idea. I know a lot of people that range anywhere between 28 and 32.
Okay.
For an adult, and kids obviously much smaller.
Yeah, of course. I know, like I said, the big average that I've always dealt with is around a meter a pace. But that's not a comfortable pace like you were just talking about. That's probably walking a little larger, and this is one of the things I'm talking about. Sometimes, like me walking across my house or me walking in the woods, I have a different stride. You know what I mean? Yeah. I walk with a way more purpose when I'm in the woods than I do if I'm just crossing across the living room. One, there's, you know, across the living room, I can pretty much see it. I know I'm not under time constraints. But in the woods, I always walk with a purpose and I always set goals, which is something else I wanted to talk about while we were chatting on, you know, walking through the woods. It's real easy to overestimate how far you can go in the run of a day, because every time we think, oh yeah, I can do 10 kilometers, that's no problem. We're picturing 10 kilometers of good terrain. Very unusually do people say, oh, 10 kilometers, if I'll be lucky to do a kilometer a day, you know what I mean? But just as you were saying in alone, that's kind of what they were averaging, was about a kilometer a day, and a kilometer's not that far. You know what I mean? Like, it's really not that far. You're not, like, that's not beyond your sight limits. If you stand in a straight line, you can see the end of a kilometer, you know what I mean? It's not that far.
No.
And only to do that in one day, that's very real, especially in like the forest you were talking about in the alders and stuff like that, or the deep boreal forest. That's tight going.
Yeah. So if you're doing a lot of climbing, you have to go through different difficult terrain. And in their case, they were given a compass bearing. So you don't get to choose the easy path. So a meandering path that's without restrictions, and a straight path that has all kinds of restrictions, you may be walking only a kilometer.
From point A to point B, but how much did you zigzag in between? Which is the other thing nobody ever counts into things.
Yeah. So it's definitely stuff to keep in mind. Like I said, I use an average of 20. If I'm planning a long distance trek, I'll look at a map, and if it's 20 kilometers or more, I consider it like an overnighter. If I can do in and out 10 kilometers each way, then I'll say that's doable in a day. Can I do more? Absolutely. But I have to be leaving earlier. I have to think about it. And then one of the things you have to consider when you are hiking, of course, is how far are you going and what are you carrying? Because if you're going for an overnight, now you're carrying more weight than if you're doing a day hike. If you're planning and cooking while you're in there, you're carrying more weight than if you're just carrying with a snack and a drink.
And this is the other misconception that I see a lot with people is, once again, let's just use 10 kilometers, 10 miles, whatever you want, nice even numbers. Oh, I can walk that. That shouldn't be hard. I should be able to do that in, let's say, 5 hours. Okay, but what's that 5 hours based on? Is that flat, even terrain? Is that not carrying weight? Is that in your sneakers? And these are all things you don't think about when you're like, ah, I can do that distance. Okay, well, now you got to put your hiking boots on. You're putting a little extra more gear on your body, probably a little thicker clothes, because, you know, as bushcrafters, we tend to dress a little thicker, layer-ish. That way we can change our body temperatures and stuff like that. Then you throw, in my case, the old 50-pound pack on your back. And not just the weight, the bulk of it. Now you got to deal with that when you're walking around. That all of a sudden, oh, I should be able to do 10 kilometers in 5 hours turns into, I'll be lucky to do 5 kilometers in 10 hours. You know what I mean? Like, you cut your time in half very, very easily. I know me, like I said, I take a little longer stride in the woods simply because I want to walk with a purpose, but that's not always your best option. And you said something I want to kind of loop back to when we're talking about topography here is, if you are trying to hurry in the woods and catch up and make time, it's very easy to lose track of the ground in some of our situations. And I know you've experienced this, Ben. Just walking through the woods, you start climbing over deadfall. One deadfall leads to the next deadfall. All of a sudden, you're 10 feet in the air. You know what I mean? And this is something that's very real when you're out there hiking, especially if there's no trails and stuff like that. You got to be very cognitive of where that forest floor is.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've done a lot of steeper terrain treks hiking, and it's neat because you end up doing a lot of switchbacks and stuff. But you're absolutely right. It's pretty easy to come up on something that you didn't expect and see some major terrain trips. The other thing you have to be very aware in denser brush is that the ground isn't always there. So I have stopped before. I was in a search one time, and my glasses, because we had to wear safety glasses in case a stick poked you in your eye. And my glasses fogged up and I couldn't see. So I took them off to clean them. And right in front of me, there was a hole about 7 to 10 inches in diameter and probably 8 feet plus deep.
Interesting thing to find. Must just been like what, underwater washout, something like that, or
it was very rocky, so like it looked like something that was had been plowed up, and I think everything had washed out, and there was a bunch of rocks, and it was just a hollow area underneath it. I don't know that it was like a perfectly straight hole, but I'm seeing that hole, and we dropped the stick down there. We didn't hit anything. It was for the length of our hiking stick, so easy 6 feet deep. And if I had fallen down, my leg would have gotten probably past mid-thigh before I'd have caught myself. And you can very easily break a leg.
Yeah, I was just about to say, now you're in a very real risk of hurting yourself severely.
Yeah, you can, it doesn't take much to cause a serious injury through a fall. And that's one of the things, if you're talking about hiking, is how do you protect yourself? Because I think there's a lot to it, and there is. I mean, we've talked about it before. Good footwear is essential.
Something with ankle support. That's the big thing. Bare minimum, get yourself something with ankle support. That way it's harder to roll your ankles. And if you do roll a little bit, you got some support in there, so you're not hopefully straining, spraining, or breaking, twisting, any of that stuff. It might be the difference between, you tweak yourself, you sit down for a few minutes, rested a little bit, and then you're okay to go a little bit more, versus if you're in your sneakers with no ankle support, you suddenly slide off a route, you get a sprained ankle, and now maybe your trip's blown for the day, or worse yet, now you gotta figure out how to get out, because you may be 5 kilometers into the woods and people aren't expecting you for 3 days.
And me and you have a very similar belief on this, but we do need to acknowledge, because it's out there, is if you go to any outdoors sporting and look up a hiker, there are plenty of hiker runners and hiker shoes that have absolutely zero ankle support. And there are plenty of people, experienced people, tell you, oh, it's great. I use them all the time. I go run trail running and this is what I wear. And I look at it and think, there's some serious risk there. But one of the things you have to know is, depending on how strong your ankles are and how much you've exercised and built it up and how flexible they are, the likelihood of you straining them will change.
Mm-hmm.
And for the average person, we aren't that strong. Like
most of us are a little heavier on the top end than we care to mention as well, which puts a lot more strain on joints and bones. I know myself, I probably have a little extra, few pounds of extra fluff. And I mean, I think realistically, what is it? Every 10 pounds that you put above your hips is something like 50 pounds for every so many angle, so many degrees of angle being bent. It's ridiculous how much 10 pounds goes anyway across your body. And most of us are at least 10 pounds, if not a little more fluffier. We can stand to lose a little more. And this is all that extra stuff going down. So, yeah, good footwear, good ankle protection. And then to follow that up, something that's comfortable on your foot and fits well. There's nothing worse than buying a pair of shoes, boots, whatever you want to call them, that just don't fit really good. Maybe they're a little too tight. Then you start getting into chafing and blisters and, you know, a whole bunch of just uncomfortableness, which not good if you're going long distance. It's a real bad time to break in a new pair of footwear on your first 20-kilometer hike.
Yeah. Yeah, I 100% agree. Besides getting good footwear, make sure that you've properly broke it in. Make sure it's properly fitting. And make sure you're wearing proper socks in the footwear.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe unpopular opinion here. I'm still a big believer in wool socks. Even in the summer, if you're hiking, they prevent quite a bit of chafing. I mean, they're not the coolest thing on the planet. I understand. But they do have a good moisture wicking ability to them. Like, they will pull some moisture away from you. And in the colder weather, if it gets colder at night, wool retains a lot of its heat value. But the big thing I like about wool is it's really hard to get blisters in a good pair of wool socks with a good pair, good fitting pair of footwear.
Yeah. Well, they make good wool socks now. You can get thinner wool socks. Merino
wool
socks.
Yeah, I'm not talking like your winter half-inch thick sheep wool socks here. I'm talking like a decent pair of wool socks.
Yeah. So you get, you know, a darn tough, or there's plenty of like smart wool type socks. And it does a lot to protect you. The military made us wear wool socks for that very reason. And a lot of people complained that they're itchy or they weren't as comfortable. But the reality is you have less injuries in wool socks than you do not. So I agree, you know, buying a decent pair of socks makes a world of difference. And I can't say enough about that. Like, taking care of your proper clothing can make a huge difference. Likewise, you know, we could go all the way up. Like, every part of this matters. Proper pants that fit, they're not too tight, not too loose, don't have areas that are chafing, don't restrict your movement. If you have to take a little bit of extra every time you lift your pants because your pants are resisting motion, that's going to exhaust you after a very short period of time.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, prime example, go walk in the snow. You're constantly lifting your legs in awkward angles, same as you would be if you don't have a good fitting pair of pants, or you're always tugging up on them. That's the one I hate. People are constantly tugging up on their pant legs, you know what I mean? Because they're just a little too long, or they bunch up around their knees or something like that. That takes so much effort over the run of a day. It's one of my pet peeves.
So, I mean, overly stiff pants and pants that stick, like if they get wet and they tend to stick to you and they will rob you of heat and they will rob you of energy.
So what you're telling me is my blue jeans ain't my best walking pants. Not that it can't be done, just not your best walking pants.
I love a good pair of blue jeans. And honestly, if they fit well and you keep them dry, blue jeans can work well. But some people wear them overly tight and some people wear them overly loose, which tends to restrict motion. They get dragging on the ground. They will wear you down. So make sure your clothes fits properly and is comfortable. And if it's not comfortable and it's not proper, then those areas are going to cause problems. Any hot spots caused to you by your clothing, that's going to chafe. And if you've ever been chafed while walking, you know that it can be some of the worst experience of your life. I have done hard days in the woods clearing trees and stuff, and I had a pair of jeans that they wore where my inner thighs rubbed because, I had a few extra pounds. And absolutely. I mean, it was like the inside of my legs were on fire. I honestly probably cried.
So Terrascout Adventures joined us here. Costco's zip-off lag cargos are great. And you know what? I was a huge fan of the zip-off lag cargos for a long time. I can hear the eye rolling across the internet right now. Oh my gosh, no, he wears cargo shorts, let alone zip-off cargo shorts. Yeah, they function. You know what I mean? They're a utilitarian product. Full lags for when you're bombing through the woods. Shorts for when you're hanging out in the sun. Sorry.
A shockingly good zip-off pair of cargo pants. Giant tiger.
Seriously?
I have three pairs that I wear religiously. My laundry just happens to be right there. And, yeah, there are giant tiger ones. I think it's Mountain Ridge. And honestly, they are extremely comfortable. I have worn the, because I'm a big fan of Mark's Work Warehouse and their house brands. What's the Wind River?
Maybe. It's been ages since I've gone to Mark's Work Warehouse, be honest with you. Not because I've got anything against them. I just
buy my own clothes. I'm a child at heart. But I had a pair of their pants, and honestly, not nearly as comfortable as the Giant Tiger similar brand. And the Giant Tiger ones outlasted them. So when I was home this summer, I picked up three pairs in three different colors, and I think I paid $20 a piece for them. So can't knock it. But yeah, find what works for you, right?
Yeah, and I think that, like you said, you hit the nail on the head there. Everything you're wearing has to fit decent. Doesn't have to be the most, you know, tailor-made suit you've ever worn, but you don't want it hanging off you, and you don't want it so tight that it restricts movement. So it has to fit somewhat decent. And yes, even a good fitting jacket is going to be better than a long, you know, a bad fitting jacket over a longer time frame, because you're not going to be screwing with it as much. You're not constantly adjusting it. You're not constantly pulling the arms up. Like, my sweater, as you can see, is starting to turn ratty, and it's just one I wear while I'm in my office. That's it. It's my office sweater, but I'm constantly pulling the arms up. Now, if I'm doing that, say, 100 times in the run of an hour, which I guarantee you I would be doing if I was out in the woods, that's going to drive me nuts. That's going to aggravate me. It's going to make me not be as careful, which is another big thing a lot of people overlook when they're out there hiking. And once again, I'm not trying to roll anyone's eyes here, but the reality is we tend to start daydreaming. We zone out. We stop focusing on what's in front of us, and you miss that hole, or you miss that wedge, or you miss that root, or you miss that rut. That's when injuries start, right?
Yep. Somebody's going to laugh at this, but we've gone this deep, and I want to go one layer further.
Giver.
Underwear.
Yeah. You know what? I don't wear tidy whities if I got to go for a long walk. I don't care. So, I'll say it. Too much chafing.
If the underwear you're wearing doesn't wick away moisture and it holds in, it's gonna make you clammy. It's going to make you uncomfortable. If the elastic isn't holding and it's just sliding off of you, or it's running up into you, it's uncomfortable.
And make sure your underwear are all there. As guys, at least, we have a tendency to hold on to our underwear probably longer than we should. There's the odd air conditioning duct, I will call it, that may appear in them. Best time for it when you're going on a long trek. Like me, personally, seeing we've gone this far, I like a nice pair of boxer briefs simply because it fits better. There's less bagging. And it offers a little chafe protection. And you can get good Gore-Tex and stuff like that that has excellent moisture wicking capabilities and stuff like that. Like, once again, you can get the Taj Mahal of undies, or you can go get the $3 Giant Tiger Walmart brands. Yeah, you're going to save a little money, but you're going to notice some differences there too.
Well, have you heard of the brand Manmade?
Yes, I've heard. Don't own.
So, I bought 7 pairs. About 2-3 weeks ago.
What do you think, man? Honestly, I know not really the time to talk about it, but let's hear it.
So it's... Hey, we're all people, right? We all have to wear. It's been amazing. And it really does make a difference. And I've been finding myself much more comfortable. I'm finding a lot less of that swampy...
Clammy feeling.
Yeah, and it's... Everything is kind of holding. Nothing's sticking where it shouldn't be. It puts everything where it's supposed to be, and it's breathable, and it moves well under the clothing, and it really makes a difference. And it's not a type of underwear. I usually wore just boxers, and I was starting to find some issues, and so we decided to try something different, and it's a world of difference. So I highly recommend people look at it and look at some, you know, spending a few dollars on it. I mean, you can spend a lot of money on other things, but where are you going to get the bang for your buck? And there's areas that, like, I recommend it. $20 pair of pants, but I'm paying $25 for my underwear. You know,
like, but I mean, you wear your underwear every day. You know what I mean? Like you said, we're all human. We all wear them. You're not just going to wear them in the woods. So it's worth it. You always need some, right?
Yeah. So there's that. And then last and not least, obviously your upper wear. I mean, obviously wear something that's appropriate for the season. So a good short sleeve shirt, long sleeve shirt, or maybe some type of layers so you can regulate your heat while you're walking. Because the reality is, a good hike, you're going to elevate your body temperature. You're going to build a lot of energy up. And some of that forms body heat. And you need to be able to dissipate that at a reasonable rate on a hike.
Yeah, because if you start overheating, one, it's not good for you. You know, you're going to drink more water. You're going to slow down. You're going to take more breaks. It's going to set your pace back quite a bit. Now, as we said way back at the start, and what you just, you know, covered again, is if you're dressing in layers, it's easy to shed some of that off. I can take this sweater off, keep the t-shirt underneath, and now I'm regulating my body temperature and I'm not getting hot, having to slow down, cool off, drink more water, because I'm sweating more, all that good stuff. And it keeps my pace up.
Yeah.
We went way further down that rabbit hole than I intended, but all good topics, all good things to talk about. And I mean, all important things in their own right. Set it right at the start. This is something we all take for granted. We don't think near enough on it. And that's all this episode is about. Get you thinking about what you do while you're walking. There's way more that goes into it than you actually think about. At least consciously, you know what I mean? Most people don't consciously dissect their walking habits, which is basically what we're doing here tonight. And on that topic of hiking and things like that, something that can add to your safety is something you and I were talking about a little earlier here, is things like trekking poles and walking sticks. Now, you had mentioned trekking poles, and I got zero experience with trekking poles. I've never used an actual trekking pole in my life. Mel has a set. I mean, I picked them up. I've handled them. I turned one into a cone picker for one of my jobs. I have seen them. I've just never actually used them while I was in the woods. I've always used a walking stick or something like that. And I have several walking sticks that I take. And honestly, it's very similar in methodology. However, you sent me a quick video there on trekking poles. And I mean, a trekking pole is a fancy walking stick with features.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Well,
it definitely is. But the purpose of it, I mean, think about a trekking pole. Some of the features are different tips for different terrains. So you can get ones that are baskets, or you can get ones that are points for harder terrain and icy conditions. They usually have like a springiness to them so that they'll absorb some shocks. There's usually a nice strap and a sturdy handle to hold on to. And they're usually adjustable to various heights, so you can sort of adjust them for the terrain and your personal height. So all really good features. The other feature that, you know, you kind of have to keep in mind is it adds a stability.
So you're saying my walking stick doesn't have any of that? And I've had this walking stick, folks, no word of a lie. And it, just because we were talking about it, this is, I'm trying to think. I got this back in 2005.
Yeah.
This is my second year working with Natural Resources where the stick came from. I found it in a beaver dam. We had to relocate some beavers. They were doing some flooding, and I found this very perfect stick at the time, which I'm never going to be able to get into shot here in any way, shape, or form. But anyway, it's just about chin height. And
yeah.
I literally pulled this out because we were laughing about government workers, how there's always one guy leaning on a pole. And here's where the walking stick came.
Hey, I have one at the cabin now, I think, but I've had it since Juan. So when trees blew down over Hurricane Juan, I made a bunch of sticks, and I put medallions on it, like little hiking medallions you can get that you nail into it. And I absolutely love that thing, and I wrapped part of it with the tape you use on golf clubs for better grip. Lasts a lifetime, honestly. If taken care of, and it has a bit of springiness, like it'll give, like, you know, it's not super rigid, like it'll flex a bit in the right conditions. What are you looking at?
Oh, I was just looking. I thought this one might have been the reason I retired. It was because it was starting to crack, but it's just a crack, and I'm never gonna be able to get this up there. Maybe.
Too high for me.
Okay. Somewhere in there. Anyway, I have a knot here, and there's a crack starting to form in it. And I think that's why I retired this one. But by far, this is my favorite walking stick I've ever made. I have three or four more in the sunroom there, but this is by far my favorite. And one of my friends that does artwork, he keeps saying he's going to wood burn that thing for me. So I keep it around and it's going to be a showpiece. But it'll get there eventually. Anyway, I derailed.
Yeah. But the thing with, you see people walking with trekking poles. And when I first seen it, generally it was often older people and people who were struggling, I think, to do the hiking, and they wanted that extra support. And, on even terrain, it gives you a lot more stability. And especially if you're carrying a heavy pack and stuff, I can see where people want. And going up a hill, you can use that to kind of boost yourself. So your arms are pushing you as well as your legs. So people say it gives them a bit of extra speed, but it also takes some of the energy out of you that your legs have to put into the walk and spreads it through your body. Argumentatively giving you a better overall body workout and helping other things. And I think I said, helped you go up a hill, going downhill, it takes the strain off your knees and your shins. And on slippery or uneven terrain gives you some stability you wouldn't have otherwise. Because if you start to fall, you can brace yourself.
And one thing that was from that video that I actually loved about the trekking pole idea is you can start using them feeler rods. As you get used to walking with them and stuff like that, and more you're used to having them in your hands, and you're starting to do a lot more of this subconsciously, the video showed me. Buddy was saying that he can put them out in front of himself in such a manner that, he's not looking down as much, because the trekking pole will let him know when there's a drop going to be ahead of him, or there's a stick or something like that, right? So you can start using these as almost another sense for when you're walking along, which is much what I used to do with the walking stick behind me. That's what I always used to use it for, was I'd stick it out in front of me, and then I would know as I was getting off the ground, off the ground, if I was starting to go up in elevation or something like that, the stick was always there. Also adds a lot of balance if you have to do some water crossings or something like that. Not that we're recommending people go out there and cross raging rivers or anything like that, but if you do have to cross any kind of moving water, having a third leg is nice. You know what I mean? It just gives you that brace. It's not pushing against you so bad. Walking through different terrains, sometimes it's just nice to have a pole to be able to rest on for a second. You know what I mean? Take a little bit of that weight. And that's what these trekking poles, walking sticks, things like that, they're doing for you all the time. So Dave joined us here, Real Big Monkey One. My hiking stick is wrapped in a survival blanket, and covering that is wrapped paracord. And that's the other thing. Once you start getting some good hiking, trekking poles or hiking sticks, you can customize these things. You know what I mean? I started tinkering with it just on the old Google machine there on my phone. And some people really, trick these things out and they become a survival stick or their survival walking stick. They have a lot of neat things in them.
I seen one guy, he took really big, Dave might have had something to do with this. I'm not sure. He took 3/4-inch PVC and he filled it with a bunch of stuff. There was a whole first aid kit and fire kit and all that slid down in little pouches, and he had strings so you could pull them all out. Had some flexibility to it. I mean, I find are great for clearing distances. If you have to leap over a small stream or a small gap, you can oftentimes use that to sort of give you that little extra boost. Having a stick or a hiking pole definitely does help. And I mean, I've always had the hiking stick. I just didn't have the two poles. I like to have a hand free to use for something else.
But that's always been my thing, is I always like one hand full, or one hand full, one hand empty, one hand full, whichever pessimistic or optimistic view you want to see on this.
But with the trekking poles, if they're worn right and you use the loops, you can free your hand to do something and then quickly grab it and continue going. And the more you get used to it, the better it is. Some of the things I've been told, though, is when you're walking uphill, you might want to shorten them a little bit. And you're going downhill, you may want to lengthen them. And I think going downhill, they recommend you change your pace so that the pole is going with the leg. Whereas when you're walking, otherwise, they're alternating, right? You move one leg forward, you move the opposite hiking pole ahead. And you can use it to slow yourself down and control your descent. But all these things are really good to learn and practice. For a lot of people, it's going to make the difference of doing 20 kilometers a day and 25 kilometers a day. You're going to be able to cover potentially more distance.
Which doesn't sound huge over the course of a day, but over the course of like a month, if you were doing, say, the Appalachian Trail or something like that, makes a massive difference.
Well, if you do 5 extra kilometers a day over 20, that's a 25% increase in what you would have done. You know, or, you know, depending how you do your math.
I was going to say, every 4 days you're saving a day. That's all there is to it.
So, I mean, it's significant. The other thing, too, is if you're into this, a lot of tents and stuff nowadays come, you can use your trekking poles as the poles for your tent.
And that's something that Jacob DeFord was talking about there. Trekking poles can be adjustable and make good tarp or tent poles.
Yeah. So if that's what you're doing and it's a dual purpose, then all of a sudden, you know, you don't find it as such an disadvantage. So it's not adding weight that's not using anyways, right? You needed a pole to begin with.
Exactly. So we do have a question from the comment. And I've been leaving it there and haven't forgot you about Terra Scout, so let's address it now. So, the question, preferred backpack styles for hiking. They have one with a mesh back and a bit of frame. It keeps the space between it and your back, keeps your back from getting sweaty or less sweaty. You know what? You're more of a backpack connoisseur than I am. So I'm going to let you lead into this question, and then I'll follow up with my regular antics.
I do like a backpack that gives you that airspace. Your back is an awful large piece of skin, and as such is very important for regulating heat, and it's also an area that can chafe a lot. So if you get something that gives you a bit of clearance between your back, that obviously holds some advantage. And a backpack holds an awful lot of weight, so if your backpack doesn't weigh a lot, then it's saving you something there too. So I look, like, if I was to buy a new backpack tomorrow, I would honestly start looking at some of the ultralight packs that have some of the less features, like less pouches, less organizational, and go with something a little bit lighter. But yeah, I mean, obviously you have to get one that fits properly, and above and beyond everything I've said already, get one that actually fits you, that has the hip straps. I feel that that's really important because that makes the weight go to your hips instead of your shoulders. It can save you a lot of stuff and trouble. And also look for something that has decent padding in anything that's touching your body so that there's less chafing and issues there. But again, lighten your load, you don't need quite as much padding. Does that help, I hope?
That's going to be a way more in-depth answer than I would have given. My answer for that would have been, depending where I'm going is going to dictate the backpack I take. I'm not so much worried about the sweaty back thing, simply because regardless of what I do, it's going to happen. I am a very, oh God, I don't want to say it that way. I sweat, you know what I mean? I run hot, I sweat, my back just, it pools sweat. I have proportionately to my height, I have a longer back than somebody my height should have. Because let me put it this way, I'm almost 6 feet. And I only have like a 27 and a half inch inseam. I am all upper body. I have no legs. So yeah, a lot of backpacks that fit really well to people with proper proportions don't fit so well for me. So a lot of these frame backpacks and stuff like that, they're designed to sit on your hips and sit on a specific type, specific height on your shoulders. And if they sit right on my hips, they're usually like 4 to 6 inches under where they should be on my shoulders. And if I pull them up to where my shoulders are, then they're like 4 to 6 inches higher than they should be on my bottom. So I don't have great luck with rigid back backpacks. That's why I wanted you to lead into this, Ben, because everything I'm going to say is going to be through, like, you know, green colored glasses here. So yeah, I don't have a preference with the backpacks I use so much that way because I haven't found one that works good for me yet. And if I ever do, you can guarantee there's going to be a video on it. So I like my Maui pack, in all honesty. It's just an old military BDU. Well, it's not even a real military BDU. It's a just some sort of, I don't know. I don't even know what you call that thing, Ben. You know the backpack I'm talking about. Anyway, it's just a standard backpack I got from literally the Army-Navy surplus store. And it seems to be my go-to for everything. Day hikes, long hikes, doesn't matter. Because it's the best one that fits on my back to now. Because nobody else liked it because they said it was just a little too long for them, which really fit me well. So it was like a $45 backpack that I just found, and that's the one I like for everything.
You know, there's so much with backpacks. For years, external frame was the way to go. You had ultralight external frames, and then you went with internal frames. You have ones that spring out so that they keep that gap between your back. I've had a bunch of military ones. There's so much to packs. We've done a couple episodes on backpacks.
We have, and I've actually acquired more backpacks since we've done that. I have 3 rigid frame backpacks here now. I think I have like 7 or 8 standard backpacks here now. I got them all the way up to like 90 liter packs. Still haven't found one that beats this one.
And I just sent you another one today. Like, just to drive you nuts. But it's just an example of where I would probably go if I was to start again. I mean, the one I've been using lately the most is still the Mountain Top. 55 plus 10, so I think it's 65 or 70 liter pack. And I mean, I like it. It has everything I need and then some. I just now wonder if I could go with something even lighter.
I should show you my biggest pack here, man. Like, it's ludicrous. I'll go take a picture of it. It's out in the sunroom, and I'll send you after the podcast.
I've also looked at the portaging ones, which are like waterproof bag that you can shove everything you own in there and just cinch it down and throw it on your back. And if you're going for short distances, it's absolutely good. But honestly, for a long distance hike, it would not be my first choice. There's too many options out there to recommend just one. And anything I recommended to one person might not be the best thing for them, but it might be good for someone else.
I guess short answer, whatever backpack fits you really comfortable. Comfort over distance is going to mean something.
I will recommend this one for children and especially smaller adults and more women. The Duder Fox 40 and Fox 30. Awesome little pack. My girls all have one or the other of those. And I really think it'll last them right into their teens, at which point we'll graduate them to an adult, more adult pack. But honestly, I've also seen some, you know, smaller women, and I've recommended that as a pack for them to check out and said, listen, you know, it'll carry almost everything you need, and it's going to be comfortable. It's very adjustable. So look for stuff that is adjustable or designed for your size. So either you know, if it's pre-designed for your size, you can save weight by not having to have the adjustability. But if that's not possible, find one that's adjustable to you.
And I guess the follow-up to that, though I'm not going to dive down this rabbit hole too far because we are hitting 50 minutes, is once you get a good backpack, make sure you're packing it correctly. That's going to go a long way when you're out there hiking around in the woods, making sure you get your items where you want them in your backpack. And we've done back in the packs episode, I think you talked about this at a little bit of length, Ben, is how to pack the stuff into the pack where it's going to distribute the weight the best. So like I said, not going to be a dead horse. Recommend people go back there and listen to that. But just don't throw your stuff in there all willy-nilly. There is kind of a method to the madness. Take a little time and figure it out.
Yeah, and there's a couple of things you really want to keep in mind. One is you want stuff that you're going to use regularly accessible, but you also want your harder, heavier items basically relatively low. Because if they're up top to the pack and they're rocking around, every time you move, that momentum, that arm, is going to be more wearing on you. So you want to keep your center of gravity always low and close to the ground, hence your short legs, right?
Yep. And the only thing I would throw into that, once again, without getting into it too deep, is don't have too much stuff dangling off your backpack. One or two things, that's okay. A lot of stuff dangling off your backpack, it just makes all this crazy momentum as you're walking, and then you're constantly trying to balance that extra weight floating around from you. If you wonder what I mean, just take a couple, like 5-pound weights, stick one arm out like a foot and one arm out full length, and then try and walk on a board. Like, your weight, you're always shifting your weight around to try and keep yourself somewhat balanced. Even subconsciously that you're doing this, it's adding so much more stress and fatigue onto you for no reason that you can just sit down, pack the bag up a little tighter, a little more close-knit, and then you don't have all that flopping around.
Well, and that's why every good backpack you will see has the cinch lines that you can keep the pack nice and tight, because exactly what you mean. If that weight is flopping around inside, you're going to exhaust a lot more energy. And I would take a heavier pack that is well secured than a light, loose pack that's bouncing around.
No, 100%. Great follow-up question by Terra Scout here. Keeping hydrated while hiking, obviously important. How are you carrying water? I think our answer is going to be similar on this, so I'm going to jump in here, Ben. If it's not similar, Ben, you just say, nope, Robert's crazy, and you go on with your own thing. But I'm going to say the actual water I carry on me, a lot of you are probably going to be surprised to find out it's fairly limited. I only keep a limited supply of water actually on me, but I keep a water, like, my Sawyer Mini. I keep water purification methods on me, and I frequently am topping up my water instead of carrying all that extra bulk. And I know, once again, some people are going to disagree with me on this one. I cut a lot of my weight out of excess water. I've traveled with guys that carry around like 4 liters of water, and it's just a giant jug of water you're carrying around, adding weight and bulk for something that you can do in like a 500 or 750 milliliter water bottle. And just every time you cross a water stream, hydrate and refill.
Yeah, I have a couple of methods, but one of them is the Life Straw water bottle. So it has the straw kind of built into it. And it's been a go-to for us lately. I mean, right now it's in the door of my car. And the beauty of this, you're canoeing, you're hiking, whatever, you pass, you know, a relatively clean water supply, you fill it up. The other thing is, once I get to camp, I have the Sawyer Mini in the back of my pack, which is lightweight, doesn't take up a lot of room, and I'll take a couple of the collapsible bags, and I've set them up into a gravity feed system.
I might have mine right here, just for demo purposes.
Yeah, and I'll fill up everything when I get there. So I pre-filter with that, because it's actually a cheaper option than the Life Straw. So I think the Life Straw isn't really flushable, at least the one in the kit. And it costs as much or more than a Sawyer Mini.
So this is literally my my whole water filtration system. This is just an old Coleman bladder pack with the open top. The bar that keeps it closed is still in the backpack. I cut the mouthpiece off it. This fits very well onto the end of my Sawyer Mini. I scoop water up, make sure there's no water running down the hose so it's not contaminating my drinking water. I pop this off, hang this in a tree, dip this down into one of my water containers, and just let it literally gravity filter water as I'm doing other activities. And a good lot of the time, you know this, Ben, sometimes the water containers overfill, but honestly, for the cost of the Sawyer Mini and how much water it filters out, I don't stress about it that much. You know what I mean? It's like a $30 water filter that's supposed to do 150,000 gallons of water or something.
Yeah. We don't expect to ever reach that limit.
If I do, man, they're like, I got bigger problems to worry about. I'll just buy another Sawyer Mini. You know what I mean? They have gone up a little bit in price, but you can still catch them for between 30, 50 bucks.
Yeah, exactly. I've seen them the other day. But the thing is, like, the Life Straw bottle I have that has the filter in it, I've seen the replacement filters for that are still 24 bucks.
Yeah.
And you can't flush them.
No. The syringe is over there. That's the beauty with these little Sawyer Minis, is they come with the syringe. You just suck up some of the good fresh water and back flush this thing, and it clears all the junk out, because this works on a porous option. The big thing with these is they can't drop below zero. If they freeze, they basically get destroyed. You have to make sure they're 100% dry before you introduce them to like minus zero temperatures. Because there's like a whole bunch of tiny little tubes in there that are down to what, 1 micron or 0.1 microns or something, like some insanely small size.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I use the same method, and it works well for me. Rarely if I ever camped in an area that's extremely dry and I couldn't find a source of water. If I was starting to travel in an area where water was much more scarce, I'd probably have to rethink my system. But honestly, right now I'm in a rainforest. It hasn't been an issue. And Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, you would have to struggle to not find water. Like,
I was going to say, we figured this out one day. We were working at Natural Resources, and I'm sure somebody out there has better information on this, but just a couple of hillbillies sitting around a map looking over Nova Scotia, we figured out it's almost impossible to go more than 20 kilometers in any direction without hitting some source of water. Be it a small pond, small river, small stream, something.
Yeah, well, I would have gone with a significantly smaller number.
What's that? Sorry, I was reading what Danny was saying there. Or not Danny,
Dave. I said I would have gone with a significantly smaller number. I can't imagine you could walk more than a couple kilometers.
I was going to say, 20 kilometers was the maximum we found when we were like taking a ruler and seeing it. Like, if you absolutely had the worst luck in the world going in this straight line, I think we found 20 kilometers.
Yeah. So, yeah. Plus, everywhere I tend to go, we went to Dover Hills one time. I went with Jeremy. And up in the top, it's all solid rock. There is absolutely no water. But when we walked down into the valleys, it was boggy. There was plenty of options for water. It wasn't the best looking water, but if you're willing to boil it and filter it, it was plenty good.
And that's the thing with these Sawyer Minis and all these things. Remember, you still got to pre-filter that water if there's large sediment. And you still may want to boil it off afterwards, depending on where you're at and what you think may be upstream. You know what I mean? So... But honestly, 90% of the time, I'm going to absolutely admit it. I scoop water out of the river, gravity feed it, and drink it.
Yeah, so do I. That's it. I don't use, normally, I do not use like a water bladder. I know a lot of packs have a spot for a water bladder, and you can run the line up to your mouth in that. I don't. I do have one I use with the motorcycle. And honestly, I'm not 100% sold that it's something I have to have or I have to use, but it is there. It is an option, and it is something I'll take on a bike trip, because on the bike, I don't want to stop and get the bottle out and drink from it and open up the helmet. It's a little easier to have those options.
My problem with water bladders on my back is I find they don't breathe. They cause more moisture, yeah. Even if the water inside it's not cold. Like, I've tried everything. I've tried throwing ice cubes in this thing and then surrounding it and stuff, and like this one here actually came with some sort of, it was just a water bladder backpack. It literally was just a backpack that had a water bladder and a tiny pocket in it. That's all it was built for. And it's just, the more I wore it, the more it was, I got wet. Didn't matter what I did to the water inside, because it's like wearing a sheet of plastic on your back. So Danny was saying he needs a life straw. You know what, Danny? I just picked one up. They're a great thing. I have the actual life straw, not the life straw water bottle like Ben has. I also has a Kadex. I think it's a Kadex water, filtration bottle, which now Lily is using. I pulled the filter out of it, but the problem is I can't find filters for it anymore, but it was a filtering water bottle. The thing with these filtering water bottles and the life straw, on like the mini, they don't work on that porous method. They actually work on a filtering method. Now the plus to that, you can, like, a lot of them have like a carbon treating element to them. So you're going to get rid of a lot of those like tannin tastes or bitter tastes and things like that. As where with the Sawyer Mini, a lot of that stuff's still coming through. You're still going to taste the tannin. You're still going to get a little of that water discoloration from the tannin and things like that. It's going to be a little bit bitter. I find with the Life Straw and similar filtering systems, it tends to get rid of a lot more of that. But they're not cleanable like this. This is back flushable. Technically, if you back flush it and take care of it, it's basically good. I use the old quote fingers and say indefinitely, because they do put a cap of 150,000 gallons on it. But I mean, as long as you're taking care of it, 150,000 gallons, that's more than I can drink in a lifetime. You know what I mean? So.
Yeah.
And Dave, Real Big Monkey One, says he flushes or back flushes his Sawyer Mini with a Coke bottle. Either just squeeze it or step on it with my body weight compressing it. And that's all this does. You see there's a flow hole on it, so water goes in, you know, dirty water in this side, clean water out that side. All you do is you put the syringe or the water bottle on this side, blow it back through, and there you go.
Yeah, and any of those methods will work. The pop bottle works very well. You can use the flexible bladders that come with it. You can screw those on the same way and just, you know, roll them out. It's just finding a way to put pressure on it. So if you want to save yourself a few grams and some space, you know, a cheap water bottle, you know, that you can get anywhere, weighs less than the syringe and works perfectly fine.
I was going to say, so this is what I've actually ended up doing, and I don't know how we jumped off hiking and onto water bottles, but screw it, we're at the end of the topic, and this is what we usually do. Smart Water has one of these tops, yeah. One of those little squirty tops, you know, you're supposed yeah. to, you know, Smart Water perfectly fits over those ends.
Oh, yeah?
So I started buying smart water every now and then. Like my Lily drinks a lot of water while we're out. So we end up buying a lot of water on the road. Unfortunately, Mel and I, we usually use reusable water bottles, but Lily can be impatient. So we get water from time to time. And I just started buying smart water. She likes the tops to drink out of, and now I collect them to use with my Sawyer Mini.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, these are all great things. We've covered a lot today.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, we're over our hour here, folks. The last 10 minutes has been on water filtration.
What to look for in good boots, hiking poles, proper underwear, everything. We have covered it. Water, backpacks. Yeah.
Yeah. Honestly, folks, once again, long story short, summing up this whole entire hour. Yes, we all walk. We all know how to walk. But it's one of those things we don't think about what we actually put into our... So, yeah. Like I said, for me, it was just one of those topics. I wanted to start getting people thinking. That's it for me tonight, folks. Final thoughts, Ben?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's like we always say, get out there, have fun, try some things. Practice, you know, it's great exercise. Hiking in the woods... is mentally there's a thing called forest bathing. Have you heard of this term?
Nope.
it's literally the act. I need to do more research. Maybe it'll be a subject in a future one, but it's literally the act of immersing yourself in the woods for mental health. There's more to it, I'm sure, but you know, a good hike through a natural environment does a ton of good for you mentally, physically, emotionally, and it really does help. Doing it in a safe and effective manner really helps. And you know, make it yours. Figure out what really works for you. Don't let anyone tell you how to do it. We by no means are telling anyone how to do it, but we're telling you things to look out for and try and test, so that you do it the safest. You know, if you're walking through heavy terrain, consider things like safety glasses. Consider wearing a good hat to keep the sun off your head for sunstroke. Consider all these little things in it, because you're out there and it's easy to forget about these little things and keeping ourselves safe to enjoy it. And when you are doing it, slow down and enjoy the moment occasionally. You know, stop and take a picture of that pretty flower, or stop and just take in that sunset or the way this mist comes across a lake or something. These are things that'll, you know, make the difference.
Nope, 100%. And I was just flipping through our comments, make sure we didn't miss everything there. But as always, get out there, have fun, folks. Everybody that said goodnight, you folks have a good night. That's Jacob DeFord, Dave, Real Big Monkey One, Terrascode Adventures and Red Sand Adventures. All those folks have their own YouTube channels. We highly recommend that you reach out to them, check out their content too. If you're liking this channel, you're probably going to like them. That's what bushcrafting is. We're all one big community and we just try and spread the word, folks. So have a good night, everybody.